poverty, the problem of poverty, looking at it from chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. The problem of poverty. Now, in my preparation time, I don't think I've covered all the stuff that needs to be said from this passage here tonight, but I want to just bring out something for you to consider. The reason I say this passage is about poverty is because of the following. It's an argument that develops from chapter 14. Look in chapter 14, verse 27 for a moment, as we just make our way into this, you see there in verse 14:27, if you cast your mind back to last week, for those of you who are here, we were looking at the way that the Israelites were commanded to bring a tenth of all that they grew in the land and then to share it, to give it to those who don't have an inheritance. And then in verse 29, it's repeated again. So all the way it starts with, in chapter 14, it starts with food, what you can eat, what you can't eat. And then with what are you going to do with the food that you can eat, share it with those who have need. And generally, this kind of sense of a welfare, looking out for the welfare of the whole community, of realizing that you're in this together. You are God's people together. Obviously, the passage here speaks about a group of people who are broadly going to be able to feed themselves. They're going to be able to look after themselves. They're going to have the resources that they need to live a full and rich life. And there are those amongst them who will have no inheritance, verses 27 and 29 of chapter 14. There's some people who won't be able to feed themselves. It's going to be people struggling in the community. That's just a fact. So what are they going to eat? Who's going to feed them? And the answer is, you who can are going to do it. You're going to give out of your abundance to those who lack. The tithe. And the people who are described here, the people who don't have an inheritance, are described there in verse 29, aren't they? The Levites, the sojourners, the fatherless, the widows. And when we get into chapter 15, which we're looking at tonight, when you get to chapter verse 4, and there will be no poor amongst you, the poor who are being spoken among there are the people who have no inheritance. But that's what's going to make them poor, because they haven't got the means to feed themselves and sustain their own lives. They're going to depend on those who can. There will be people who are going to be dependent. So what is going to become of the poor? The problem of the poor. They're going to be amongst you. The people are going to be amongst you. And it's going to be the responsibility of the wider community to take care of them and to look after them and to feed them. As we get into chapter 15, verse 1, looking at this passage, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant release, and this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he's lent to his neighbors. He shall not exact from his labors his brother because of the Lord's release, and so on. Of the foreigner, you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release it. See, that food now. Life, we all need to eat, don't we? All need enough charity to make sure we're not starving. But you need more than that in life, don't you? You need opportunities. You need to build a life for yourself. Just having food in your stomach, that keeps you going from day to day. But you need something in your hand, don't you? You need something in your hand. Because otherwise there's this big shortfall. Even after all the tithes are in and everybody's been fed and there's nobody hungry in the land, still people are going to want to build a life for themselves. Where are they going to get the means? Where are they going to get the substance to build lives for themselves? And that's what Moses begins to follow on, the argument. He's following through an argument. You see, he says at the beginning there, that you're the children of God. Chapter 14, verse 1. You are the sons of the Lord your God. And that's plural. He's talking about the whole community. They have a special relationship with God. But he's talking about everybody. All of you are. And because you're all in this together, you've got to show that practically so that nobody's starving amongst you, nobody's got lacking food to eat. But it's more than that. It's not enough just to leave it there and make sure that you've all got something to eat. But you're going to have to borrow. Some people are going to have to borrow from each other, and some people are going to have to do the lending. If you've got to give, lend it. If you need it, ask. It's all down to this whole issue in chapter 14, verse 1, being the sons of God. We'll come back to that at the end, what it is to be, why this is in some way, shape, godly. Why is doing this in some way being like God? Being God's family together. Every family has different people in it, doesn't it? You've got a wide variety of people in your families. And God's family is like that too. There are going to be the haves. There's going to be the have-nots. That's true for Israel. That's true for the church. It's true for any society, isn't it? In Great Britain, there are the haves and there are the have-nots. There's also those who have lots and have less. There are some who have more than others. And this is a reality that Moses focuses on. He's being very realistic about this. Because the truth is, at the very beginning of this, the whole argument about kosher, about what you shall eat and what you shan't eat, marking out the things that you shall eat will show that you're the sons of God. Well, if you've got nothing to eat, things seem irrelevant to you, don't they? If you haven't got enough to get on with your life, you say, well, this isn't for me. I can't survive within this community because I haven't got the basics that I need to make my way through life. And you can see how people could just fall out the bottom of a society like this, fall through the floor of a society like this, if people won't lift them up and hold them, hold on to people so that they can continue to be part of the covenant. Some people have said, haven't they, that sort of the Bible and Jesus, they've tried to liken it to socialism. I think that's a very unfavorable connection. I don't think that's a connection that you can realistically make. But there's a profound social conscience being expressed here. Here, there's a group of people amongst whom they anticipate there will be social inequalities. There will be differences between people in their society. And it accepts that there will be differences between people in the societies. But it doesn't accept, refuses to accept, that those differences are going to become so great, so almost to such an immoral level, with so little compassion being shown between those who have and those who don't. The wealth gap will grow out of all control, so that society will literally split between those who have and those who don't. This passage keeps those people connected. Those people are going to be borrowing and lending, communicating with one another, staying in it together. So it doesn't come to a point where people literally have nothing to do with each other because of the differences in the way the Lord has provided for them. That awful line. I mean, I don't even know if it's a true story about Marie Antoinette when she looked out the carriage window and heard all the people crying. What are they crying for? They're crying for bread, Your Majesty. Well, let them eat cake. Now, we don't condone the fact that she lost her head, but you can understand when a society becomes the differences between one end of society and the other, where they have no understanding of each other whatsoever, no connection between them at all whatsoever, that a society like that is breaking apart. Here, Moses is determined, there's going to be differences, but you are going to remain one. You're going to remain connected to each other. You're going to support one another and stay as one people. And what's going to break them up is if, like the prophet Isaiah later had to go back to verses like this and had to castigate the people that he was preaching to at that time. It's recorded for us in the opening of Isaiah chapter 3, verse 15, for example. What do you mean by crushing my people, he said. Crushing my people, grinding the face of the poor. You've heard the expression to grind the face of the poor? It's Isaiah. It's Isaiah. If you turn your backs on your own people because of their poverty and grind the face of the poor, that this expression is followed by, thus says the Lord your God. This is my people. My people. What will happen to society if there's no charity? What will happen to Israel if there's no charity, no heart, no feeling, no common feeling for each other? What will happen to a church if there's no charity, there's no desire, no common feeling? What will happen to our country if there's no heart, no compassion, no common feeling? This is the subject that Moses is speaking about as he speaks to Israel. And you've heard the expressions about the rich just getting richer and the poor just continue to get poorer. And that's what happens. If you get stronger and stronger and you show no compassion towards those who can't cope, they are weak and vulnerable. Of course, they just spiral down Those who are stronger just get stronger and stronger. Unless you have a heart. Unless you have a desire and recognize and acknowledge one another. That you are the children of the Lord your God. That you have a father, your brothers and sisters. You're in this together. And what will result, and in the passage begins to follow it through, as you get from verse 11 onwards, you foresees the situations where people end up selling themselves into slavery to their own brothers. Their situation becomes so impoverished that they have no option but to voluntarily give up their liberties, give up their freedom, submit themselves to those who have, because they have not to such a degree that they are willing to give up their liberty, their very liberties, to strike a deal. And people are living in situations where they are beholden to their own brothers and sisters, as it were, who have become their masters, rulers and masters. That's what in verse 7. And you can end up in a kind of virtual slavery. We've talked about it former times. You all know about it. You hear about it in the news. People are living as, they're basically living in slavery. They may not technically be slaves, but they are in wage slavery, aren't they? In all sorts of places in the world. Their life counts for very little, if nothing, but as a means to produce further wealth for others. That's immoral. It's immoral. Well, and it's particularly focused on in this passage, and it comes down to it when he's talking to them about the reasons why, verse 15, the reason it's so particularly immoral is because God came down from heaven in power to salvage these people from their slavery, not to bring them to a place of such riches that they then reduce their own brothers and sisters to the very same slavery. Surely, if that's what he's done for you, the last thing you should want is to do that to somebody else. If you remember what it was like to be a foreigner in another person's land, the last thing you want is to treat a foreigner like the way you were treated in your land. If you were reduced to slavery in another person's land, the last thing that should happen in your land is that one of your own brothers should be reduced to slavery. It's on God's dealings with them, how God has treated them, and they are the children of God, so they have to do likewise. Isn't that what discipleship's all about? It's to, in some way, shape, or form, do the sort of things that God does as He empowers you and strengthens you to do it. Surely that wouldn't be His will. There's been, I listen to Radio 4 as I go and do the school run or something like that, get little clips of it. And I was listening to a scientific study that's been people's attitude to privilege. I mean, these things are relevant to talk about this time of year because, firstly, it's winter, it's getting cold. And, you know, if you're doing all right and you've got central heating and you've got food on your table, you really, really appreciated it in the winter, don't you? And when you haven't, you really know it. You really know it. And at Christmas time especially, the shops are full and everybody's celebrating. When you have it, oh, it's great, isn't it? But when you don't, you really know about it. And they were doing this scientific study I was listening to about attitudes of privilege. Attitudes to privilege. I think I shared, a couple of weeks ago that the 1% of the world's population own over 50% of the wealth. 1% of the world's population own 50% of the wealth. And I think it's true to say nearly everybody in this country is in the top 5% of the wealthiest people in the world. When you go down to the supermarket and you put 5, 6, 7 bags in the back of your car or whatever it is, you're exercising a measure of privilege that is really incomparative. When there are people living in India who are living on 0.39 cents per day, right? That's 30p a day as an average income in India. That's not because there aren't people who earn a lot of money in India, because there are people who earn a lot of money in India, but the number of people that don't is so great Now, I know I'm here to talk about world poverty or Europe or Britain and politics and the church, and but we're talking about Israel first and foremostly here. But these things do have relevance. So if you're all right, and I think we can all say, can't we? By the grace of God, we are. What is our attitude? Scientific study was saying that. Now, obviously, it's a scientific study, so they don't talk about grace. They don't talk about the favor of the Lord on their lives. They call it luck, don't they? That's the atheist's version, you know, because they don't want to see it as it being there being an interpersonal event here, that God is actually dealing with you in your life, and there's a moral responsibility you have to him, your father. They want to talk about his luck, you know, it's an impersonal force that just kind of happens in the world. But even in that context, people who see themselves as lucky to have what they have, they see that in some way, shape, or form, it's not just based on their own merits or their own work or their own rights, are more generous than people who see, I have what I have because I've worked for it and it is mine. Those people tend to be far less generous. Who think that they have what they have as if might is right, they have it by rights. And I think one of the great concerns has got to be in an atheistic age like ourselves, like ours, is the people's attitude to privilege. They will harden their hearts. They'll say, I'm not accountable or responsible to anybody. I have what I have because I've worked for it and it's mine. And even in times of unprecedented wealth. We are living in times of unprecedented wealth. People, even in my childhood, if a person lived to 70, that was a good life. Do anybody remember when people lived to 70, that was considered, you know, that's what you... Now it's 85 plus. That is wealth. We're living in times of unprecedented wealth, and yet, there is a lack of charity in ordinary dealings with people one towards another that I think is not how it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. In terms of being a community, people who looked out for each other. I'm not saying that there isn't charity now, because there is. There's wonderful things going on, and thank God for it. And so there should be. So there should be. But the present times in which we're living, if I can shift away from this for a moment, or just apply it, if I can put it like that. It's interesting that the solution to the problems that Moses is saying, to their social problems, to avoid these kind of social problems, is that the people will lend to each other and people will borrow from each other. Have you heard, never a borrower or a lender be? It's not in here. Okay, it's not in here. It's a positive view to credit, if I can put it like that. And a lot of the social inequality we're dealing with at the moment is after a terrible banking crisis where people were borrowing, but not for what they needed, but what they wanted. And now people can't borrow for love nor money. And this is causing a lot of problems. This passage has a very positive view of borrowing and lending, and it does not criminalize the poor. Poverty is not a sin. It's just something that exists within their community and has to be addressed and dealt with, dealing with the problem of poverty. You've heard, I'm sure today, this whole idea of the undeserving poor. The undeserving poor. People are poor because they're lazy. That if you haven't got in this life, it's because you haven't worked for it, or you haven't tried hard enough, or you didn't concentrate at school. That's just the way it is. That doesn't seem to be the attitude that is being expressed here. I, from my experience, I don't know what your experience is, but most people work pretty hard. I think it's the exception rather than the rule. Some people say, well, it's drugs and all this sort of thing. But I think there's as much of an argument to say drugs are as a consequence as it is the cause. Let me just turn your attention to Proverbs. The ladies group, you had Proverbs 31. Haley, where's Haley? You did Proverbs 31, didn't you? With the women's group the other night. I'd like to have been a fly on the wall for that meeting. A lady fly. Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31, we all know it well enough to know that passage is a hymn in praise, at least in part, of thrift and enterprise and industry and shrewdness and all the things you need to get on well in life. Yes? It exalts all those virtues, and they are virtues indeed. But do you remember what else it exalts? She's charitable, isn't she? She gives to the poor. So she works very hard, but she's not self-righteous. She's generous-hearted. She uses her privileges and she cares about those who, for whatever reason, seem to not be able to have what they need. But if you go to chapter 31 with me, to verse 6, it's quite interesting as well about this. It's just a kind of an interesting note, really, because it's in the same passage as all those things we've talked about. And it talks about alcohol. It's quite a surprising verse. It says, give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those who are in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. People drink for all sorts of reasons, and it's a happy thing to do at Christmas time or whatever it is. People for whom it is just blotting out the pain of their life because of the misery of poverty. Poverty is a misery. And in Israel, there were to be no poor among them. They were to take care of the poor, to lift them up, to give them opportunity. It's not enough just giving them bread and a meal. They need to be able to borrow. They needed to be able to borrow something that they could do something with and build a life. You see, charity is wonderful. But you need to borrow and invest. You've got to build something. And somebody needs to give you a break. Somebody's got to give you a chance to do that. Did anybody see the 50 years since the photographs were taken of the slums in Britain? Did anybody see that on television recently? So 50 years ago, a photographer went around some of the sink estates and the slums in Britain. He took these photographs of people in squalor, in this country, abject squalor. Shocking photographs. And then the photographer tried to find some of the children who were in those photographs, standing there on the streets with nothing on their feet, black from the dirt, playing amongst the garbage and the rubbish. Found them grown up and interviewed them, talking about the experience of abject poverty, the poverty trap. They might have had enough, just enough to eat, but they couldn't get out, couldn't do something. And the psychological damage it did to them. And they all felt, how they felt abandoned, and bereft, forgotten, overlooked, unloved, except by those who were in the same situation with them. And then they try to find people who are living in the equivalent under the line of poverty in this country today and go and find the people who are in temporary housing, people who live in streets today, and look at their lives. I have to say, by comparison, the poor today have many more things. But their sense of abandonment and isolation, even the communities that these people were part of 50 years ago, were some comfort to them. There was such a bleakness about their lives. They seemed all so, so far from home. And you know what great... Did anybody see this program? Because there was one light shining through this, what otherwise a rather bleak television program. And he's a little Scots chap about this high with a big bushy moustache. And he was going out on the streets. And he was looking at the homeless and putting his arm around them. And he knew them all by name up in Newcastle. And he had a bag with sandwiches in it. And he had a t-shirt for God so loved the world all over his t-shirt. And come along to the gospel hall. We'll get you something to eat. And he was talking. He was being interviewed. I mean, it was a completely secular program, but I mean, Christ amongst the poor. What a witness. Who this little guy was. I don't think he ever dreamed for a moment that he was ever going to be the center of a television program that was going to be broadcast nationally. But the Lord had his plans. What a wonderful witness. Giving people the dignity and the affection of somebody who knew their name, because the system kind of holds people together, doesn't it? The system's there, but it's an impersonal thing. We don't just need a system. We need love. We need to be part of a community. We've got to know that people care. The people who have care for those who don't, and vice versa. If we try and live up to that thing, that as far as the rest of the world is concerned, we're a Christian nation. We may see it so very differently as believers ourselves. But let me tell you, when the Turks, the Albanians, and the Bulgarians, and the Liberians, and these people coming from all around the world coming to this country, in the main, they think they're coming to a Christian country. And what they find here is, in at least in some measure, what they think Christianity is. Roundtree brought out a report saying in work poverty, this is people who are working, full-time working people. The number of people who are living below the poverty line in this country has risen in 10 years from 2.8 million people to 3.8 million people who are working their socks off and aren't able to get above the poverty line in this country. They need a break. It's the rents for the people who own the property. And their incomes are suppressed and the cost of living is going up and they are trapped. Homelessness is rising steadily year by year. One in 50 people in London, I think, hasn't got a home. Sofa surfers and people sleeping on the streets. There was a time when banks were not money-making machines. Banks were there to provide credit, liquidity, opportunity to invest in a home, to invest in a business, to start it. And people expected to pay that money back. They intended to pay that money back and make their way in the world. Banks can be a really good thing. A really good thing. Moses telling them, you know, there will always be this problem amongst you. It's not going to be. And in one sense, it will remain, as I said last week, an indictment against any society that the poor remain amongst us in their poverty. But it's also an opportunity to show the love and the grace of Almighty God. To build the kingdom. There's such a pastor's heart, I think, when I read through all this, and he anticipates, doesn't he? Tells that sort of little enactment. If a poor person comes amongst you in one of your towns, in verse 7 here, don't harden your heart, don't shut your hand, don't say to yourself, oh, the seventh year is about to come. Do you remember that bit when you're reading through it? You can picture it, can't you? I'll lend to you, but I want it back. And that's fine. That is the deal, isn't it? You lend, you borrow, you get it back again. But you go, wow, I'm not sure how good a risk this is. I think, you know, there's a chance it's only 2 months till the end of the seventh year. This guy, you know, I'm not going to get it back. Give it. Give it. Lend it. Lend it. You might get a pleasant surprise. You might be lending to an honest person who really wants to go, doesn't want to exploit the system. Do you think most people want to exploit the system? I think there are people who want to exploit the system. There are, aren't there? There always have been. There always will be. Don't let it get to you. Don't let it get to you. But the truth of the situation is there will be some people who will not be able to pay you back. They can't. They may want to, but they can't. And this passage tells us every year you should sit down with the books and just write off the debt. Let it go. Don't chase them. Don't chase them down, hunt them down like animals. Don't squeeze it out of them. Don't wring them by the neck till they've paid every last. Don't throw them in debtors' prisons. Let it go. Just let it go. It's not being a soft touch. The wicked, there are some people who have no intention of paying you back. Lend us a fiver, I'll pay you back. And you know, really? You're never going to see it again. Just give it. Do you remember the story of this? I know it's only a story, but Les Miserables. You know, Jean Valjean, he comes in, he breaks into the house, doesn't he? And he steals the candlesticks. Or he doesn't break it, and he's welcomed as a guest, isn't he? That's right. And then he goes, and the candlesticks are going. He gets arrested. They bring him back, and the bishop chap's sitting there, and they say, "Look, we've caught him. He's red-handed, and all the rest of it." I gave it to him. You know, we're blessed, isn't it? To be reduced to having to steal—that's a terrible place for a person to end up being, isn't it? We're not condoning it. But we are called to love even our enemies. This is the heart of this passage. You can imagine the person being sold into slavery, having to be sold, they're so reduced, their situation is so reduced. Verse 11 onwards, they have to sell themselves into slavery. And what they could reasonably expect is they will have no future. But in the hands of children, they won't be treated like slaves, they'll be treated like servants, and they'll work and they'll be expected to do good, but at the end of it they will leave and be given everything they need to start an honest life. Set them up so they don't have to come back here again, to the point where even some people will have discovered in that relationship a relationship so good and healthy and wholesome that when the seventh year comes, they actually say, "Excuse me, would it be all right if I stayed? This is what I want to be a part of. You've become family. It's like family. We're a community." And this is the great template, isn't it, of God's dealings with you and God's dealings with me. We were bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt. In sin, hopeless, not a chance. Nothing in my hand I bring. You would come to the very gates of heaven and you could knock and shout and holler and plead and ask, nothing you could give or offer could get those doors open. The debt you couldn't pay. The debt you couldn't pay. Could you pay your debt? Did you even try? Even you tried. I tried to be good. I tried to and I just sunk deeper and deeper. The more I thought I was getting out of sin, the deeper I fell into it. The more I discovered in my own heart. Did he forgive you? Did he put a mark through your debt? Did he cancel your debt? Did he let you go? Did he set you free? But did he not just set you free, but did he set you up with a new life? Not just forgive your sin, but give you the righteousness of Christ and clothe you in righteousness. Did you come back to, I'll be a servant in your house? And he put a cloak upon you and a shoes on your feet and a ring on your finger and a feast. That's Jesus. That's the heart of God. That's his dealings with us. To the point where, at the end, when he says, you know, like, you've become a Christian now, do I have to follow you and do what you say for the rest of my life? Perhaps the attitude you come in with a little bit like that at the beginning, you know, does that mean I have to go to church every Sunday and all this sort of thing? Until you come to a point where you've come under his discipline, you've come under his covering, his lordship. And the time comes where he says, you can go now. You can go now. It's all right if I stay. I don't want to leave you. I don't want to leave you. I found love. I found love and community. I found the love of God. Let me stay. Let me stay. Bonded together. Bonded together. That's what you want, isn't it? In a community, in a church, in Israel, in our country, in the world. A sense of bond. A sense of oneness. Obviously, the application of chapter 14 is not, thou shalt not eat shrimps. That is not the application from chapter 14 for Christians today. And the second part of chapter 14 is not that you've got to give 10% of your food to the poor. That is not the direct application from the passage. And the direct application of chapter 15 is not every seventh year you've got to forgive all your debt. That is not the direct application. It's about the Spirit. It's about our hearts. It's about being a generous people. A people who've received much and therefore are ready to give much. Forgiving, kind. Because that brings glory to your Father who has been rich towards you. Last section, just passing comment. There's a whole bit about giving your firstborn males and the herds of your flock from chapter 19 onwards. Give your best to God. Not half measures. Give your best to God. Give him the glory. There's that whole becoming other people's debtors and other nations. You shall rule over them. Wouldn't you like to think that this kind of influence would be the sort of influence that impress other people and impress? Wouldn't you like to think other countries would live like that? Like this? Would the world be a better place? But we've got to do it ourselves. We've got to do it ourselves. Let's sing our closing hymn. 493. 493. O come.